Hello and welcome to Beyond Markets by Julius Baer, a series featuring conversations with experts to share recent market developments, key insights, and strategic inputs from around the globe.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Mark Matthews, Head of Research in Asia at Bank Julius Baer, and welcome to our weekly Beyond Markets podcast. As Dorothy said in The Wizard of Oz, we're not in Kansas anymore. We've left where we were and entered a strange new place. For example, the 10-year Treasury yield is back at 4.5%. 2 weeks ago, I don't think anyone would have said that was going to happen. And the stock market bull market has lost some steam with the S&P down 2 weeks in a row. The two big things behind both of those are the March inflation reading and the Iranian attacks on Israel. Let's talk about the attacks first. When we look back at the 40 or so other shock events like this since World War II and then what the S&P did after, there's no obvious thing on the surface. 2 out of 3, the index was up a year later, and then in 1 out of 3, it was down. So that doesn't really tell us anything. But when we look a little more closely, we can see that the events that caused only a little or no damage to the economy were the ones where the stock market went up and vice versa. For example, when John Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, that was a terrible tragedy. But a year later, the S&P was up 20% because there was no direct economic impact. Then 10 years later, there was the Yom Kippur War and the oil embargo. And a year after those, the S&P was down 40%. Because the Arab states stopped selling oil to any country that supported Israel, which included the United States, and the oil price went up 370%. Superficially, there's some similarity with today because the Yom Kippur War was a war between Israel and its neighbors. Well, Israel and Iran have been locked in a shadow war for years. It's out in the open today, and the fear is if it spreads out into a very out in the open and obvious war, then that could mean less oil supply from the Middle East. But actually, even after this attack, the oil price is the same that it was 2 years ago. And there's a few reasons why. For one thing, nobody is talking about an embargo today. The Iranian delegation and the United Nations issued a statement saying the matter can be deemed concluded. It also said it is a conflict from which the United States must stay away. That seems to be what the United States intends to do. According to the Arlington, Virginia-based news website Axios, U.S. President Joe Biden told Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu that the U.S. will not participate in any Israeli counterattack and won't support one either. Because, and I'll quote Axios directly now, Biden and his senior advisors are highly concerned an Israeli response would lead to a regional war with catastrophic consequences. End of quote. Also, the global economy's reliance on oil is much smaller today. Oil intensity, that's the amount of oil required to produce one unit of GDP, was 0.12 tons of oil equivalent in the 1970s. It's only 0.05 today. And in the 1970s, the world relied heavily on a few Middle Eastern producers, so they had massive leverage. Supplies come from many different sources today. For example, Russian and Venezuelan exports could pick up as Asian and other buyers hunt for bargains or the West temporarily relaxes sanctions. The U.S. shale industry could ramp up drilling and production to boost cash flows. Chinese imports, we think, are going to cool off because of an ample domestic supply situation. And we think Saudi Arabia and its allies are going to eventually come under pressure to ease their production curbs. All told, we look for the oil price to go down from around $90 a barrel, where it is today, to around $75 a barrel a year from now. Now, what if Israel chooses to counterattack Iran, you may ask? Assigning probabilities to that is no easy task. On the one hand, Biden just said if you do it, you're going to be doing it by yourself. Well, 60% of the Israeli defense force is tied down in Gaza. On the other hand, Saturday's response purportedly cost Israel $1.5 billion. Just because the system works, which it clearly does, doesn't mean Iran won't try again and again and again. For Israel, $1.5 billion is a lot of money. It seems to think messaging is just as important as action, and Iran doesn't have a defense system. If there is a move to take out military facilities in Iran, like was done in Iraq and Syria in the past, it's difficult to say how the market would react. Axios says it could lead to a regional war with catastrophic consequences, according to White House officials. But the response might be surprisingly sanguine, depending on what else is happening at the time in the world. Even if the situation in the Middle East gets better, it doesn't take away from the other thing I mentioned that the market's worried about, which is inflation. I know it seems a little overshadowed by the Middle East, but actually what the Middle East is doing is making everyone think about the 1970s and the big oil shocks that happened back then because of the Middle East. When you overlay our inflation rate since 2013 with the inflation rate from 1966 to 1986, there's actually an amazingly good fit. Unlike back then, oil prices haven't spiked up this time. But clearly the assumptions economists made about inflation have been too optimistic, because there have been 4 months in a row now that the actual inflation number has been above what the consensus thought it would be. And the March reading looks like it might be starting to trend up again on a year-on-year basis. What has some observers more worried is the month-on-month reading. The month-on-month readings have been accelerating basically since last summer. In the second half of last year, they only averaged 0.2% per month, but in the first quarter of this year, they've been averaging 0.4% per month. Going forward, if the month-on-month number averages 0.1% for the remainder of the year-on-year number would be 2% by the end of the year. Now, that's the Federal Reserve's target. That would be very nice. But if the month-on-month number averages 0.3%, then the year-on-year number by the end of this year would be 3.9, and if it averages 0.4%, which I'll remind you is what it's done so far this year, then the year-on-year number by the end of this year would be a whopping 4.8%. Former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers said last week that because of inflation, you have to take seriously the possibility that the next rate move will be upwards rather than downwards. He said the likelihood of that is still low, somewhere in the 15 to 25% range. But he also said, we do not need rate cuts right now. So let's look under the hood at the price changes in the March inflation basket to see what's going on. Auto insurance was the thing that went up the most. It's only 3% of the basket. But because it went up 22%, which is such a huge increase, it was responsible for 0.6 percentage points of the 3.5% rise in inflation in March. In other words, if you took it out, inflation would have only been 2.9%. After auto insurance, the biggest culprits were rent inflation up 5.7% and housing inflation up 4.7%. Together, they're 36% of the basket. There were three other items that were also above the overall inflation reading of 3.5%, but none of them are more than 0.5% of the basket itself, so let's just concern ourselves with rents and housing and auto insurance. First, on auto insurance. The inflation there has gone from 4% last summer to, as I said, 22% as of March. One explanation is that, as we all know, COVID caused a huge increase in car prices. Now, that increase has gone down. But still, that huge surge in car prices spilled through with a lag into other car-related items. First in car repairs, now it's spilling through into insurance. Plus, new cars are a lot fancier today. They have lots of additional technology, like semiconductors and sensors, so it makes them more expensive to insure. The good news is, if we look at auto repair inflation, that was running at 23% at the end of last year. It's come down to 11% as of March, which admittedly is still a high number compared to the pre-COVID rate of about 4%, but it's a big drop from what it was. So you'd think with auto insurance, the same forces of nature will prevail. People won't buy such expensive new cars because they can't afford to insure them. They'll buy cheaper used cars instead. That'll cost less to insure. Bad news is, there is another reason why auto insurance has gone through the roof. Many older police officers are retiring, and not many people want to join the police force after George Floyd and the Defund the Police movement. So there's not enough police, and car robberies are given a very low priority over other more serious crimes. They almost never get solved. Car robbers know that too. Over 1 million cars were stolen last year. an 80% increase from 5 years ago. Still, you have to ask yourself, would the Federal Reserve really not cut interest rates just because of auto insurance? Is auto insurance really the kind of thing that's going to cause inflation to generally surge higher again? And would keeping rates high really make any difference for auto insurance? The answer to all three is no. Then on rent inflation and housing inflation, it's a controversial topic, but there were over 1 million new immigrants who entered the United States legally last year. Who knows how many went in illegally? Most immigrants are poor. They can't afford to own their own home right away, so they rent. In fact, the Federal Reserve's own March minutes said, and I'll quote them here, some participants noted that the increased immigration, which had likely been boosting the growth of personal consumption spending, may also have been adding to the demand for housing. End of quote. Ironically, high interest rates may also be a problem. They've taken mortgage rates up to about 7%, and so the average monthly mortgage installment on a new home is $2,750, which is 11% higher than what it was last year and 25% higher than the year before that. So a lot of people can't afford that, and they have to rent instead of buy. Well, not only is rent inflation derived from rent prices, the housing component is too. Housing inflation is calculated by asking homeowners how much they think their home would rent for. So ironically, if the Fed cuts rates, it would mean less renters and more buyers, which would push down the housing inflation rate, as well as the rent inflation rate. And I know this sounds like a broken record because you've heard it many times before. But when we look at the real-time rent prices, like the Zillow Rent Index, they've returned to their pre-COVID levels. And that infers the rent and housing components of the inflation basket are going to continue to come down from 0.4% month-on-month, which is where they are as of March, to around 0.2 to 0.3%. If that happens, the overall year-on-year inflation number won't go up. I'll finish by taking a few lines from the monthly update of our chief investment officer, Yves Bonson. Global leading indicators like purchasing managers' indices have not only started to recover, but are now back in expansionary territory for both services and manufacturing. Given that strong growth backdrop and the March CPI inflation reading, the Fed can afford to err on the side of caution. But the actual amount of rate cuts doesn't materially change the outlook for risk assets, unless central banks cut rates to fight an economic downturn. In an environment of structurally higher but contained inflation, equities are to be preferred over bonds strategically. End of quote. Indeed, overshadowed by all the noise about the Middle East and inflation. First quarter earnings kicked off on Friday with the big banks. They're not nearly enough to draw any larger conclusions for earnings, and their dynamics are very different from other companies. But what we can say is even if rates don't come down much, that shouldn't make much of a difference for earnings. The average maturity of an S&P 500 company's debt is around 7 years. Almost 80% of them are at fixed rates, and only 5% matures every year. Meanwhile, artificial intelligence can't happen without trillions of dollars of investment in infrastructure, and that'll stimulate the economy. So when we look at consensus estimates for 2024 earnings, they're looking for 11% earnings growth this year. And for 2025, the consensus expects 12% earnings growth. It's just hard to see stocks going down in an environment like that. This is Mark Matthews signing off for now. On behalf of Julius Baer, we wish you a very pleasant week, and we'll speak with you again next week. Goodbye.
You have been listening to Beyond Markets by Julius Baer. If you like what you've heard, please tell us by leaving a review and rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Subscribe to Beyond Markets on your favorite podcast player to stay up to date with our latest episodes. To learn more about Julius Baer, our people, our latest thinking, visit us at www.juliusbaer.com. We will be back with a brand new episode soon. The information and opinions expressed in this podcast constitute marketing material and are not the result of independent financial or investment research. Please refer to www.juliusbaer.com/legal/podcast for further important legal information.